Good evening. Good evening. My name is Karen Morton, and I'm the Executive Director of Good Beginnings of the Upper Valley. And I'd like to welcome you to tonight's 9th annual Dorothy Campion Corcoran Fall Parenting Lecture, sponsored by Good Beginnings as well as the Norwich Women's Club. We're just glad to see all your faces, and thank you for all you had to do to make tonight possible, all the babysitters and changes in schedule. Welcome. Before I introduce our speaker this evening, I'd like to tell you a little bit briefly about Good Beginnings. Probably many of you are familiar with it, but for those of you who aren't, Good Beginnings is an Upper Valley nonprofit. It was started 30 years ago by a group of women, including Dorothy Campion Corcoran, and it has been serving families of new babies ever since. It's run by really 100 approximately volunteers, and they are scattered throughout the Upper Valley, really in quite a wide range of locations, ranging from as far north as North Haverhill to as far south as Springfield, Vermont, reaching over to Killington and Bethel, Vermont, and down 89 all the way to Warner. So we have about 100 volunteers who serve families of new babies by visiting once a week for 12 consecutive weeks, any time within the first 6 months of the baby's arrival. And that can be through birth, adoption, or even foster children. So we are just really thankful for all that our volunteers do. They visit those 12 consecutive weeks, and they just provide some respite and rest and companionship and connection to other community services for the family of the new child at a time that can be really a vulnerable time and sometimes very isolating. That's our in-home volunteer visitor program. We also have a education and support program, and we provide community connections as well as education on babies, parenting, and we provide emergency resources such as diapers, formula, gas cards to doctor's appointments, and things like that. So along with our education, we provide this annual fall lecture, and we are really pleased tonight to bring to you Jess Leahy. Jess is a veteran middle and high school teacher. She's a contributing writer at The Atlantic. She's a commentator at Vermont Public Radio and the Parent Teacher Conference columnist at The New York Times. She's the author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. And this book was released in August and has already become a New York Times bestseller. She lives with her husband, a DHMC physician, and her two boys in Lyme, and she can often be found cross-country skiing on the back trails of Lyme or tending gardens in Lyme Center. So please help me welcome Jessica.
All right, how's my mic? Can everybody hear me okay? All right. So I have been a teacher for a long time. In fact, I waddled into my first classroom when my oldest son, Benjamin, who's actually at St. Johnsbury Academy, when he was still in here, and he's about to be 17. So I've been at it for a while, off and on. And I actually went to law school to be a juvenile lawyer. I thought I wanted to work in juvenile court and work with kids who, I had been working there as an intern for a while, and I had seen, you know, kids that, you know, wanted to go home but couldn't be released because their house was under surveillance as a crack den, and then their mom is all mad at us, and so she throws a microphone at our head in the courtroom because we've sent a sheriff out to arrest her so that she'll come in and actually be there when the blah, blah, blah. I loved every minute of it. It was just great. But I was asked to teach a class during law school, and I came home that first day, and my husband, Tim Leahy, he's an infectious disease doc here, he was in med school, and I came home after that first day, and he looked at me, and he said, "Are you even going to finish law school?" Because it was so clear that I was sold. That was it. I was a teacher. It was done, all over with. So I did finish, but my kids have been with me through the whole thing. I mean, they used to sit in the front of my classroom playing with the little Thomas trucks and Thomas trains, and I remember teaching a class on Huckleberry Finn one time, and Benjamin was, I don't know, he was like two or three or something like that, and he would repeat words I'd say in class, so his little voice would come up from the front of the room, and he'd say, satire, and, you know, it was great. So anyway, so that first summer I taught was fantastic because it was at Duke. It was called the Talent Identification Program, and it was a boarding program. So at the end of the summer, the parents came to pick their kids up, and I had fantastic relationships with them, and it was all great. And I'm like, why are teachers complaining about parents? This is fantastic. Of course, they weren't there the whole time. So that first summer was really, it was sort of an idyllic experience for me, but it wasn't a realistic experience for me. And the reality of sort of what it's like to be a teacher started to settle in when I started teaching right out of law school. And it was just little things at first. Like I had I was teaching a class on advanced placement language and composition, and we were working on a paper to get to know each other. And so I handed this paper assignment out, and it was parents here of some of my students. There are a bunch of them, which makes me really nervous. Will recognize this assignment. I always give it at the beginning of the year, and the students are just supposed to write about who they are. The assignment is, who am I? Not that I expect a 15-year-old to know who they are, but that I expect them to be able to just sort of do some writing about it. And this one girl, she just went really pale and started to kind of sweat a little bit. And I said, her name was Cameron. I'm allowed to tell this story because she tells it all the time. She started to sweat a little. I said, Cameron, what's going on? She's like, I just need you to tell me what you want. I'll give you what you want, but you can't just give me this open-ended assignment. And I said, well, I just want you to talk about, you know, who you are, that kind of thing. And she's like, yeah, but I need like a rubric or something. I need you to tell me what I need to do to get an A. So, you know, the little weird stuff like that. She's now a surgeon, by the way. So that sort of stuff would happen. And then there were other strange things like I would walk around the classroom while I was giving a quiz, and I'd touch the kids' shoulders, sort of check in on them. And this one boy was taking a Latin test once, and I put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, you know, he was kind of rigid, and I said, what's going on? And I looked at his test, and he had question one answered, and he had about four words on question two. And I said, no big deal, just move on. I could tell he was stressing out over the fact he didn't know how to answer question two. And I said, no big deal, just, you know, keep going. And he looked up at me with these big blue eyes, and he said, I can't. And he couldn't. It was like 10 minutes into the test, and he couldn't move past question two because he didn't know a perfect answer to question two. Fast forward a couple years later, I'm working with a kid in a writing class, and I learned pretty early in my career that unless I want to know what the parents' writing skills look like, we do all of our writing in class. And we were editing some papers, and I was giving feedback to this kid whose, you know, his topic sentence didn't relate at all to his thesis, and we were talking about that. And his head is going like this. Like, he's supposedly hearing what I'm saying, and I'm giving him feedback on his paper, but it's never changing in the actual paper. So I called up his parents, and I said, you know, I'm a little worried about your son in terms of his ability to hear feedback. Criticism of any kind just seems to make him bug out, and he seems to, like, disassociate and go somewhere else, and his head's still doing this, and he's pretending like he's hearing me, but I don't think he's really hearing me. And his mom said, I got it. Thanks. And sort of hung up the phone. And I said, okay. Okay. And then a couple hours later, I saw her car pull into the parking lot, and I saw her march out of her car and march into the cafeteria, and I saw her walk out with her son and get in the car with her son. Now, I wasn't in the car, so I don't know what happened in the car. I do know that her son came back to my class doing this, you know, that kind of that cryy breathing thing. So whatever went on in the car, it wasn't pleasant. So now I'm in a really weird situation where I don't think he's in any physical danger. I don't think. But at the same time, I don't really want to call that mom anymore. That's not sort of a happy place for me. And I certainly know it's not a happy place for her son. So now I'm in a situation where if something important comes up, I'm worried about picking up the phone, might not pick up the phone. And, you know, the parents are supposed to be the allies. So I was getting, for those of you who are parents in here, I was getting really mad at you guys. And it was really, it was starting to put a real wedge between me as a teacher, just like you, the teacher, and you guys out there. So then I had a student. I'm sort of moving back and forth in time on purpose because it freaks me out that I'm talking in the community where I taught. And so I had a student where I assigned a paper on Huckleberry Finn. You had to talk about whether or not Huckleberry Finn was a racist novel or not. You had to commit to one side, and then what they didn't know is I made them argue the other side. And this student had been sort of freaking out and having some physical issues and some emotional issues, and I knew that was going on. If she had come to me, I probably would have given her extension, but she never came to me. And she handed in her paper, and it just didn't sound right. It didn't sound like her. So I Googled some strings, and it didn't sound like her because it wasn't her. It was some person on the internet who wrote this paper and posted it on the internet. And so I called up her parents, and I said, I'm really sorry. It was her mom, actually. I said, I'm really sorry, but I have to give your daughter a zero for this paper because she plagiarized it. And the mom said, well, you can't do that. And I said, well, I kind of can, actually. And she said, no, you can't do that because she didn't write that paper. I did. Now, setting aside for a moment the fact that she didn't write that paper either, what am I going to do? I have no recourse. But in that moment, I also realized this mom was doing what she really felt was best for her daughter in that moment. Her daughter was, like I said, was having some real stressors at that time. And so this mom was just trying to give her daughter a break, to take one thing off her plate. And as a mom, I completely understood that motivation. And so this all leads up to this sort of day when, and some of this will sound familiar if you've read the introduction to the book, where I was teaching a double block of writing in English, and I was teaching at the same school where my younger child went to school, and his kindergarten teacher is here, so it's pretty exciting. And I was teaching this class, and he was actually out at recess. And we were working on eighth grade essays, which I love because they're talking about something important during their education, and they're going to read the part of these essays at graduation. It's like the best thing we do all year. I love it. And they're writing about graduation, except for one girl, and she's one of my more tightly wound students, and she's she just can't seem to get anything down on paper. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, do this thing where you just do a free write. You put your pen to paper, and you just keep it moving and sort of see what comes out. So she says, okay, I can do that. She gets her whiteout out. She gets her little erasers out. And I said, no, sweetie, this isn't like a whiteout situation. This is a, you put your pen to the paper, and you just write. And she said, okay. And she did that, and she got some stuff out on paper. And in the meantime, I looked out the window, and I saw my my then third grader. This was it was warm out. It was right near graduation, actually. And he had short sleeve shirt on and shorts. And you know when you have boots on that are too big for you, and so they're really more like full leg casts than boots because you can't bend your knees, so you have to kind of walk like this. He's out there running around the playground in, you know, t-shirt and shorts and his full leg cast boots. And so I'm a huge fan of checklists. I love checklists. And I always kept one stuck to the front of my plan book, and I would always write down things like, you know, if a student asked me, you know, why is the sky blue? And I say, oh, heck if I know. And so I put why is the sky blue on there so I can look it up for them. Or what I have to grade that night. So I have essays, grade essays on there. And then I have the word sneakers with a question mark on there because I got to figure that boot thing out. And then we move into English class. And for some reason, all the boys are fighting over this one, well, actually all of the kids, are fighting over this one soliloquy from Henry IV, Part 1. Normally, the boys fight over the sword fighting scenes so that they can break all my yardsticks and then bring their pretend swords in and do battle in front of their parents. And it's like the highlight of our spring. They love doing this. But for some reason, they're all fighting over the soliloquy that has no sword fighting in it. So I don't understand what's going on, but I put that down on my message, on my checklist to check in with them about that and figure that out and work out who's going to get to read that and who's not. So that evening, I'm looking at the essays, first item on my checklist, and I get to my uptight student's essay. And she's written one paragraph. And it's a really beautiful paragraph because she's edited it. Because, of course, she can't do anything else. She can't just leave it and misspelled words and stuff. But she wrote, some people are afraid of heights. Some people are afraid of water. I am afraid of failure. And then in these cute little paragraphs, it says, which, for the record, is called atychophobia. She had to define it. And then she goes on to talk about how her fear of failure not only renders her slower as a ski racer, because as you know, with ski racing, those of you who do it, you have to kind of be on that line between control and lack of control, and she just can't go there because she's so focused on being perfect about everything. And then with learning, she said, this has rendered me incapable of enjoying learning anymore. I'm so focused on the grades and so focused on the points that I can't just like learning anymore. So this is clearly more than I can deal with before dinner time. So I call Finn into the room and I say, Finnegan, you know what's up with the sneaker situation? You were wearing your boots at recess, and what's up with that? And he said, well, my sneakers are at Matthew's house. And I said, no, they're in the mudroom. I just saw him. He said, oh, no. Those are my sneakers with laces. So I have this, like, one of those moments where you're like, where I realize, oh, man, he won't wear the sneakers with laces because he's, I think, the only third grader who can't tie his laces. And I did that because, you know, you have to get out in the morning and it's just easier. If, oh, sweetie, I'll just do it. It's faster this way. Or, you know, once it became an issue, then I started buying, you know, those great slip-on shoes that you can get at L.L. Bean that don't even require laces. And then there's Velcro. I didn't, you know, he doesn't have to learn about the laces because there's Velcro. But every time I told him he couldn't do it, every time I said I'd do it for him, I was essentially telling him I couldn't do it, which put me in a precarious situation because all that mad I was at you, yeah, I'm there. I'm with you guys. And I can't just blame you anymore for creating kids that are incapable of being competent and incapable of speaking up for themselves and incapable of liking learning because they're afraid of looking stupid. And that was pretty devastating. It was pretty devastating because I knew that I had to change basically everything about my parenting and my teaching. This ended up really influencing my teaching as well. So I went to the bookstore and I started looking through the parenting books, and those of you who have been there lately have noticed the section has grown a lot. You can find out, you know, how to toilet train your baby the moment it drops out of the womb, to you shouldn't toilet train your baby ever because it's too emotionally scarring and horrible for them, and so you should do, I don't know, it's crazy what's in there. So what I read there, mostly sort of from a perspective of it, as I tried to approach it like as a journalist, okay, well, I'm going to find out what the research is on overparenting and figure out what to do. Well, the problem is none of the books explained what to do. They gave me all the research, and they explained to me all the stuff I was doing wrong, but they made me feel really bad. Like, I would finish the books, and I'd say, well, now I know I really suck, but I don't know what to do about it. So that's what I wanted to write. That's what I set out to write, was a book that explained what to do about it. Based in the research on human motivation and autonomy, supportive parenting and teaching, and fix my kids and fix my students and fix me, I guess, because I was at the root of the problem. So here's what I learned. So I started with Dan Pink's Drive because it seemed like the obvious place to start, because he wrote a really great book about what motivates human beings. And one of the great things about getting to do this speaking stuff is I actually was at a conference last week with Dan Pink, and he gave me the updated version of Drive. So he sort of said, oh, I said, you know, I talk about you in my talk, and I still sort of rely on Drive. He's like, oh, let me give you the update. So he sat down and he gave me all the updates, and it was great. So basically what we have is 40 years of research. And by the way, there is a bibliography at my website. If you go to jessicalehi.com and you go to speaking and about, there's a PDF of the bibliography. So everything I'm going to say in terms of books, articles, websites, they're all there if you want them. We have 40 years of research. And we don't just have 40 years of research. We have meta-studies looking at the 40 years. We have studies looking at 40 years of research to figure out whether those 40 years of research actually are solid. And they are. We have 40 years of research that says basically this. There are two kinds of motivators. There's extrinsic motivators and intrinsic motivators. Extrinsic motivators are motivators that come from without. EX in Latin means from without. And intrinsic means they come from within. And they're not just motivators. They're also controllers, like extrinsic controls. So they can be good or they can be bad. So we have like intrinsic motivation can be things like, or excuse me, extrinsic motivators can be things like rewards, lollipops, carrots, grades, points, scores, all things we kind of consider positive reinforcements, but they can also be like grounding and surveillance and control and nagging and all of those sorts of things. Like, sweetie, when are you going to do your homework? Now? Now? You're going to do it now? That's sort of a, you know, an extrinsic control over homework. Those things, unfortunately, are terrible for long-term motivation. Now, let me just explain when they do work really well. If you want someone to do something that requires short-term laser focus, and when I say short-term laser focus, think of a 10-year-old's attention span. Laser focus, you need to clean your room in 10 minutes. You need to assemble as many blocks into the shape of a triangle in the next 2 minutes. That's the sort of attention I'm talking about. If you reward people with short-term incentives like bonuses or whatever for those things, it'll work great. If it's not creative, if you have someone on an assembly line and you want them to screw 10 more bolts on a or nuts on a bolt over a period of an hour, you can offer them money to do that and it'll work great. However, anything that requires long-term attention, planning, sort of executive function stuff like setting a goal and then knowing how to work towards it or knowing that there are a certain number of steps to get there and you have to kind of put them in a certain order that makes sense, or if it requires creativity, extrinsic rewards are a nightmare. Now, we've relied on this system both in business. We give short-term incentives and bonuses and all that kind of stuff in order to motivate employees, and that's why most of the good research on extrinsic and intrinsic motivation is based in the business world. In other words, if you apply this to education, if you want your kid to lose interest in learning math, pay them for their math grades. It's that simple. And if you want someone to be less invested, less personally invested, less creatively invested, and spend less time on creative endeavors, pay them for their work or put controls on their work. So, for example, let's say all of you guys are artists. Half of you, I'm going to commission an artwork. And I tell you what, I like dogs and I like blue. So could you please put some blue and some dogs in there? I put some extrinsic sort of controls on what you do. You guys know controls. You assume you're going to sell paintings eventually, but you don't really have any... you're just painting because you're painters. That's what you do and you love it. It's your thing. You guys will spend less time on your paintings. You will be less creatively involved in these paintings. You will be less invested in these paintings. And they will be less creative. They will be less innovative. Interestingly, your painting technical level doesn't decrease. You don't become lesser painters just because I pay you for your paintings. But you are less invested in them. You guys... it stays the same, and you're able to sort of go at that with your creativity. And it works with kindergartners, too. If you guys are all kindergartners and I say, here's some canvases and some paints and go crazy, but to half of you I say, and then I'm going to bring in some experts, and they're going to gauge how good you are at painting, and we're going to give some awards. You kindergartners will be less invested, spend less time. Your paintings will be less creative than yours will. So if you want to rec creativity, start rewarding people for it. So, what do we want then? Well, we want intrinsic motivation, and those of you who are teachers know what it looks like. It looks like the bell rings and no one moves, and you call up the French teacher and you say, I'm sorry, Madame Moore, but the kids are going to be late to class. Or you go into your kid's room and they're so engrossed with whatever it is they're doing, Legos, whatever that thing is, that time just, you know, they don't even really hear you. The epitome of this is what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls flow. It's that state where you're so into the thing you're doing and it's just the right level of difficulty. It's not too hard. It's not too easy. Time falls away. For me, it's cross-country skiing. For my older son, it's guitar. And for my younger son, it's Minecraft. These are the things that make time disappear. They are at one with the thing, whatever that thing is. And the only way you get that is through intrinsic motivation. You could get paid for it incidentally. Like, I would be writing whether I get paid for it or not. It's nice that I get paid, pays the bills, but I would be doing it anyway. So it doesn't depend on the pay. All right. In order to be intrinsically motivated, here's what you need. You need three things. You need to feel autonomy, which is kind of like independence, but I'll explain that in a second. You need to feel competent, which is different than confident. And you need to feel connected. This comes from Edward Deci. He wrote a book called Why We Do What We Do, The Science of Human Motivation. Brilliant book. So, well, here's the problem. If extrinsic motivators don't work for long-term creative endeavors, I'm in big trouble. Because at its best, education is a long-term creative endeavor. So I've got to figure out a way to engage my students without dangling points and scores and all that stuff in front of them. And that's going to be hard, right? Because that's the currency of education. It's going to be easier at home because I can get creative there because that's my area. But school's going to be tough. All right, let's talk about autonomy for a second. There is a researcher, her name is Wendy Grolnick, and she's out of Clark University in Worcester, and she researches autonomy-supportive parenting and what that can do for kids and what kids look like when they have autonomy-supportive parents versus controlling or directive parents. So she brings a bunch of parents into her lab. Half of them, well, they all happen to be mother-infant pairs. That's just the way this study went. And she puts them, she explains to the moms, be there while your child completes this task. Those are the directions, really general on purpose. And then she puts them in a room with one-way glass so she can watch them and she can code their behavior. Some of the moms are there, and their child is over here completing a task. And maybe the kid gets frustrated, but the mom kind of redirects, but doesn't take control and doesn't direct. Some of the moms, and I'm sure no one in this room will recognize any of this, say, oh, no, sweetie, the blue one on the green one. No, the light's coming in from that window, so turn it that way so that the light really falls on it. Oh, that's good. Yeah, do it that way. Those parents were labeled, as according to Dr. Grolnick, as directive or controlling. I'll use the word directive because it's nicer. The parents over here who sort of let their kid get frustrated, let their kid sort of do their own thing, those parents were called autonomy supportive parents. Now, here's what's really interesting. The second day of the study is always the interesting one. They came back, and she separated the parents from the children. And she put the children in the room by themselves, gave them a task. Now, God knows what you give a one-year-old is a task, but she gave them a task and and then watched. The children of the autonomy-supportive parents started the task with enthusiasm, got engaged in the task, got frustrated, and sort of pushed through and finished the task. The children of the directive or controlling parents started the task with enthusiasm, got engaged with the task, got frustrated, cried and gave up. Almost all of them, actually. She refers to the results of that study as stunning. She said it was really, it was a stark contrast to her. The ability of the children who have, when you have directive or controlling parents, you're less likely to be able to push through frustration because you just haven't had to do it much, right? If you're a parent who solves the problems all the time for the kid and doesn't let the kid sort of work through those problems and get to a place where they can then be resilient and sort of try the next thing, then let's move ahead a few years. So one day I was in middle school, and I came out of my office, and there was a girl in the locker room, and I love this girl. She's just fantastic, but you can always tell when she's having a bad day because she has wavy hair that she likes to make look straight. So when she gets really, really bad bedhead, what she ends up with is a big blob of hair on the back of her head that she then kind of skims a little bit of hair over the top of it. And then you can always tell that's when a bad day has happened because she didn't bother to sort of work out the rat's nest. And she was looking a little anxious. And I said, sweetie, what's going on? And she just went on to tell me about how little sleep she's getting and how stressful homework is and how she's just feeling so defeated. And so I called up her parents and I said, you know, I'm really worried about your daughter because she's clearly just overwrought more so than usual. And I'm really worried about her anxiety levels. So, specifically, it seems to be around homework. And her dad says, I know, every single night, her mother sits on one side of her at the table and I sit on the other side of her at the table, and we work through every homework problem together, and every night it ends in tears. I don't know what else to do. And I said, well, I have an idea. How about she does her homework at the dining room table and you are present, like in the house, like shouting distance away, but not there. And she's going to make some noises. And here's what some of those noises are going to sound like. And, but you got to not listen to that, not hear that. You got to kind of, this is like a toddler use your words kind of moment. She's got to actually get to the point where she says, could you help me out? And then when she says that, you say, try it one more time from another angle. Maybe look at it differently. Maybe move on to the next problem, and that one might give you help with the thing before. But don't go right away. And that has worked, I think, over time. Although I had a conversation with this kid recently, and she's headed off to college, and we were talking about how excited she was and stuff like that. And she said, yeah, but I am really worried about my parents. Like, I don't know what they're going to do with their time because, you know, they spend all their time on me. And I said, I think they'll be okay. I think it might be hard at first, but you got to know when to let go of your parents, sweetie. So that autonomy, giving kids autonomy, that's what it kind of looks like. You're there. You do not leave your kids to flail about and cry and get frustrated, but you do encourage them to take that second look, to push through frustration on their own so they can learn those coping mechanisms, because the teachers in this room know what the kids who don't have those coping mechanisms look like, and they eat up a lot of our time because those kids do not have the emotional wherewithal to experience frustration. It just causes them to fall apart. So helping kids move past that by gently encouraging them to take on and withstand a little more frustration while moving on, you know, that's where we want to get. We want to get to a situation where you can say, you know, try it another way, and then you don't hear it again. Or you get to a point where when your kid says, no, could you come help me? I'm really stuck. That you know you can trust that. And that means I really, really am stuck. And then maybe you can help. But you help in a teacherly way, not in a let me give you the answer kind of way. Because frankly, while it's interesting on kids' math homework to know what you guys know, when we ask a kid to explain how they got that answer and they can't do it, that's not particularly helpful for anyone. All right, competence. Competence is like confidence but different. Confidence is like that kid who shows up on the first day of kindergarten and says, my mommy says I'm the best reader in the kindergarten class. Bring it on. It's going to be wonderful. That kid has no experience with kindergarten, right? That kid just is going on what he's been told about how wonderful and brilliant and talented he is. Competence is something different. Competence is when you can work from a place of feeling confident because you've actually got some experience. That's what we tend to deny kids. Now, the way you get competent is this, and this is frustrating for parents and it's frustrating for kids. Let's say you've got a math problem, and your math teacher has taught you how to do it this way in this context, and maybe taught you how to do it this way in this context, but then you have a homework problem, and it asks you to do it this way in this context, and your kid says, this is so unfair! We didn't do it this way in class! And you say, your teacher must be really great, because you know what that's called? That's called a desirable difficulty. Desirable difficulties are a concept that's been around for a while, but they were outlined in this book, Make It Stick, that came out last year from Harvard University Press that I love. Desirable difficulties look like this. If I gave you guys a piece of paper and asked, well, I'm going to give both of you a piece of paper, and I'm going to quiz you on it in 3 minutes. Your piece of paper is missing some words and some letters, so you have to decode a little bit. You have to work to figure out what's on the page. You guys get the whole thing. It's clear. It's really obvious what's on the page. You don't have to work very hard to decode it. You guys over here will be able to recount more of what's on that piece of paper when I quiz you in 3 minutes, and you'll know more of what's on that paper in 2 weeks, even if I let them review it right before the quiz. That's because when we do what's essentially cramming, right? It's that thing we all did in college where we try to stuff it in and then we put earplugs in so nothing will fall out. But then it does, like the second you're done with the test, because you know you've shoved it into short-term memory. You haven't gotten into the long-term memory. You haven't encoded that information. But if you have to work a little bit to get it in there, you're encoding that information in a much more durable way. And there are lots of things that can create really durable long-term learning. Desirable difficulties is one of them. Now, we don't give a kindergarten kid, you know, a calculus problem and say, you know, go at it. Boy, you'll really understand calculus. But we do give kids a certain level of difficulty. So one of the things that I've been called to task for in the past is, you know, you assessed my kid on this concept, but in a different way than you taught it to them in the first place. And I said, yes, I do that on purpose. And the kids say, the parents say, that's not fair. Putting aside for a second that the way we assess kids is all wrong, and what we should be doing is giving them frequent, low-impact, low-stakes assessments, and then forming our teaching to sort of get back at what they didn't know, as opposed to teach, test. Sorry, can't take it over again. That's it. What you got is what you got. Test, teach, test. That's a nightmare. That doesn't work. That encourages you to cram and shove it in your ears as fast as you can. However, frequent formative assessments are a great way to actually force kids to recall the information over and over and over again. It's why flashcards work and why cramming doesn't. So those sort of desirable difficulties, frequent formative assessments, letting kids take a risk a little bit further than where their comfort zone was last time, all of that is what creates long-term learning. And that's what keeps kids interested. And some of you have seen this experiment where you put like a trash can right in front of you and you ask the kid, right in front of a kid, and ask the kid to throw the ball into the trash can right here. Well, that's not very interesting. You lose interest after a couple minutes. Or if I were to put it over there by, you know, the first row, and that's kind of hard. But if I put it in the middle, I'll stay interested for a good long time because that's kind of in the sweet spot of difficulty. That it's just difficult enough. And that's sort of the best way to foster competence, is to sort of hit that sweet spot. Now, for those of you who haven't read Carol Dweck's Mindset, please do. And also read what she's been writing lately in the media about the fact that we in the media are getting mindset all wrong and oversimplifying it. Shocker, the media gets something wrong. Apparently, people have been oversimplifying the idea of fixed and growth mindsets to be that all we care about is effort. So a fixed, for those of you who don't know, Carol Dweck's research is about fixed and growth mindsets. If I were to give all of you a little quiz, let's say a math quiz, and it's all right in your, you can all do this, it's all right in your capability area, and I come up to you later on with your grade and I say, oh, sweetie, you got an 8 out of 10, you must be so smart. And then to half of you I say, oh, you got an 8 out of 10, you must have worked really hard. And then I give a second quiz that's slightly harder, you guys will do the same or worse, and you guys will do the same or better. Okay, so that's interesting to me. There's something about encouraging people, saying, you know, that you worked hard at something, that sort of gets this message across that that working hard is good, and just being smart, there's something about that that's bad. But then she takes a little step further, and it'll become clear sort of how this all works. At the end of this quiz, I say, at the end of the two quizzes, I say, I have these challenge problems. Who wants them? You guys over here who were praised for being smart, you want nothing to do with the challenge problems at all. Whereas you guys who were praised for effort want the challenge problems. There's something, in fact, one girl in the experiment says, you know, of course I want the challenge problems. They're the fun ones because you have to work harder. Here's what really interests me as a teacher. Then I say, or Carol Dweck says, I'm going to give you all a piece of paper, and I'm going to do this quiz at another school. So if you could write down sort of what you thought of the quiz. Oh, and you know what? While you're at it, write down your score. You guys over here who were praised for effort, wrote down your score. 40% of you lied about your score. You bumped it up. So just by creating this fixed mindset of I'm smart, and I'll explain it a bit better in a second, I turned you into cheaters. In fact, there's a fantastic book called Cheating Lessons by James M. Lang, and he explains why that's the case and how if you want to create a cheating-free classroom, you encourage as much intrinsic motivation as possible. What is it about calling you smart? Well, we tend to stick a lot of labels on kids, and we have our positive labels of talented, gifted, smart, creative, you know, you're just so good at math, you always have been good at math, or here's the worst one, this is the worst. Oh, sweetie, you got an A on that test, and you hardly had to study. We sort of encourage that idea that not only do you have to be smart, it has to be effortless. You have to be smart, and it has to be easy. Now, when I offer you those challenge problems, you see those as the fastest possible way to reveal that that maybe isn't true. So if you've been told you're smart your whole life and suddenly things get hard, you tend to go into fight or flight mode and you want to protect that. So you'll cheat. You're going to be much more likely to cheat if you have a fixed mindset, if you believe that the amount of smart that you are is just the amount of smart that you are and that doesn't change. Because God forbid, maybe you had an IQ test at 11 and your mother told you, oh, sweetie, you are 140 IQ, you are so talented. And then something gets hard in seventh grade, as it tends to do. And then all of a sudden, it's not easy anymore. And you say, oh, I can't let anyone know. I got to keep this quiet. I got to not ask any questions. I got to not show anyone that this is hard for me. And if that means I have to cheat, if that means I have to lie, steal, whatever, to keep my grades up, I'm going to do that. But you guys seem to understand, actually, there's not much I admire about the Korean educational system. What I do admire about the South Korean educational system is that their concept of intelligence is not based on what you're born with. It's based on the concept that anyone can be a math scholar. Anyone can be a music scholar. It'll be harder work for some of us than for others, but if you work hard enough, you can do it. It's a combination of talent and effort, and it's much more skewed toward the effort. In the United States, boy, we love prodigies. We love those kids that'll walk up to a piano and play a sonata the first time they touch the keys. We're not as interested in a person who's put in their 10,000 hours and can play that sonata beautifully. It's not as cool. You know, it's not quite as sexy for us. We like the precocious prodigies, and we want them. We want it just to look easy, like, wow, they just picked up that violin and it just flowed out of them. But that's not how things work. Everything gets hard. When I was one of those kids. I coasted. School came easily to me, and I just was one of the smart kids. And so I got to law school, and so when I was presented with practice exams, I didn't take practice exams. Practice exams are for people that aren't smart, right? They're the ones that have to work at it. And it's a writing exam. I'll be fine. And I've been understanding what's happening in class. I don't need to take a practice exam. So when I got a 68 on my civil procedure exam, my first instinct and this is what happens with a fixed mindset kid when things get hard or when they get their first F. I have to quit. I walked toward the dean's office with the full intention of quitting law school after getting that first grade. And luckily, a friend of mine intercepted me, and she said, why don't you go talk to the professor? So I did, and I went to his office. I was not going to cry, and I totally cried. Went into his office, just lost it the minute I walked in. He said, what's up, or something, and that was it. I lost it. And I said, and he said, well, how did your practice exam go? And I said, didn't take the practice exam. And he said, well, there's your problem, right there. Well, you have taken a practice exam now, and you got a 68 on it, and so on the next one, you're going to do much better because you now know what a law school exam looks like. When I talked to my friend Steve Strogatz, who's a mathematician at Cornell, and I talked to him a lot about there are a bunch of kids out there that are told from really early on that they're just good at math. That's where their talent lies. He says those kids get to Cornell, and they're screwed because all of a sudden it gets really hard, and those kids for whom it has been easy that entire time need a little mental health semester. A lot of them leave because they don't know what to do when it suddenly gets hard. They don't know how to bounce back from that. They do quit. They don't have that person who helps talk them down, and so they do quit. And that's what I'm hearing more and more from college professors, are kids that show up at school and get that first F and just lose it because they don't know how to handle it. And then they go home and then their parents call and say, what did you do to my kid? Yeah, that happens a lot. Competence. Autonomy, competence, connection. Connection means different things to different people. To our friend Edward Deci, it means interpersonal connection, that we know the people who are around us will love us no matter what, that they don't love us based on performance. I'd like to just take a little sideline and mention that, you know when a kid comes home from school with a test and they say, Mommy, look, I got an A. And you're like, oh, let's put it on the refrigerator. It's so awesome. You hardly had to study. And then they come home with the F and they're like, and you're quiet. That quiet, that's withdrawal of love for performance. At least that's the way kids hear it. And that's really bad. That's really, really bad. So ideally, and I know some of you are familiar with Vicki Hofla's work with duct tape parenting and that kind of stuff. She has a great idea. You deal with it the same way. That A and that F, what'd you do to prepare for that? How did that go? What might you do next time? What did you try this time that worked? What did you try this time that didn't work? What are you going to take forward with you? What are you not going to take forward with you? More emphasis on process than on product. And I am going to go off on a quick tangent here because there's something that has been, and I'm hearing it more and more at school when I go talk at schools. I was at a school recently where 650 parents showed up, and the most common question I got from those parents was, what do I do about, how do I handle the parent portal situation? So for those of you who don't have kids in high school, parent portal, so as teachers, we have access to software that helps us with our grades. And it's great. We don't have to do as much work, and it allows us to keep track of things over long periods of time. Some schools have decided to open up what's called a parent portal. So you as parents can log on and check your kids' grades as many times a day as you would like. And for some of you, that's a lot. And you know how I know it's a lot? Because we can see. And here's the other thing. We talk about it. And we think less of you for it. And this is why. People who are checking on those portals 10 times a day, and that's not, I'm not exaggerating, aren't talking to their kids. And they're certainly not encouraging their children to talk to their teachers. And they're not using the software in a way that's actually fostering your relationship with your kid. What you're doing is you're using the extrinsic control of surveillance and micromanaging to, you know, to deal with kids' grades. Now, you could do things, you could handle it the way we decided to handle it in our family, which was the envelope came in the mail, and I handed it over to my older son, and I said, I won't be using this because I would prefer to talk to you about school than to talk to a computer. And let the teachers know that I wouldn't be using the portal. Now, for those of you that gives the cold sweats to, and I just came back from Palo Alto, and let me tell you, there are a lot of cold sweats happening in Palo Alto. You could maybe open the envelope but say, I'm going to check it on Friday, and it's Monday, and if there's anything I need to know, could you go talk to your teachers, and we'll sit down together on Friday and look at it together. One of the reasons I bring this up is that this is a really small community. And grading portal software damages parent-teacher relationships, parent-child relationships, and student-teacher relationships. Because you guys know when we've graded and when we haven't. And so when we see you out at dinner and you ask us how the grading's going, which you do, some of you, it has happened. It happened to me at the dentist once. That degrades the relationship, and it's really, really harmful. So if you have never jumped on the parenting portal before, I would just encourage you to think about why you're doing it and how you're doing it before you do that. Connection to me means one other thing, though, as opposed to just parent-teacher connections, student-teacher connections, parent-child connections. It's also the connection of what we learn in the classroom that it matters out there, or that what we're learning at home matters out there. And I get this story all the time. My kid, I got this one recently, actually. My kid doesn't want to do her homework, and she doesn't want to go to school because she says her grandfather was a dairy farmer and her dad was a dairy farmer, and she's going to be a dairy farmer, and none of this matters. And I said, dairy farming is awesome. Think about it. Math. You have to use math to figure out input and output of cows. You have to figure out genetics. You know, when you get the catalog, and believe me, this happens, you get the catalog for the bull semen in the mail, and you got to look at the genetic charts and figure out the dominant and recessive traits of the cows so that you can of the bull so you can figure out what you want in your dairy cows. You have to test your soil and figure out how much selenium is in the soil so you know if there's enough in the grass to support the calves. There's all kinds of stuff you can do to connect the stuff that your kid claims they're not interested in to the stuff they are interested in. And if that means you get on YouTube and you watch shows like The Brain Scoop with Emily Grassley, her job at the Field Museum at Chicago is she's chief curiosity correspondent. And she has a show just talking about natural history museums and linking it to cool things. You could go watch Vsauce. Michael Stevens has a show called Vsauce. There's a couple of them, but his is my favorite. And he'll ask questions like, what would happen if everyone in the world jumped at the same time? So that question requires population density, mass, gravity, plate tectonics, all kinds of cool stuff. You could watch Mythbusters. You could watch History Channel. There's so many cool ways to link what we're learning in the classroom to stuff out there. And by the way, that's where education is moving. Education is moving away from lectures. Education is moving more towards problem-based learning or project-based learning, more experiential, for better or for worse. And some people are doing it great and some people are doing it poorly. It's moving in that direction. So I think there's hope in terms of that and in terms of all the ways to get more kids more intrinsically motivated. So I have about 6 minutes left, and one of the things I wanted to do is tell you a little story about what this can look like. And those of you who have read my book or have read some of the articles about my book in the media might recognize this example. So I have a younger son. I write about him a fair amount with his permission because he's a tween, and therefore, as a tween and a boy, has a little trouble with his executive function. He can't seem to keep his stuff straight. He can't seem to get, like, he can get the homework into the bag, but then getting it back out of the bag and, like, doing it and then putting it in the teacher's hand. There's glitches in the system somewhere. Well, that's because they have underdeveloped frontal lobes, right? Their frontal lobe is not developed. They tend to rely more on their amygdala, which is sort of like the, you know, in the moment kind of stuff. But that planning stuff, it just doesn't, it's not there yet. And it's not there for any of them, really. So let's start talking about that as being a normal thing, which we've been doing. So things have been going pretty well, actually. We have all kinds of fun systems in place, all of which I suggested. And one day he goes, I come downstairs, he's out at the bus stop, and his homework is sitting there on the table. And guys, it was so pretty. It was math, which is not his favorite, and it was so pretty. It was all done and complete, and everything was where it was supposed to be. And I have to be at the school in 1 hour. And I know I can't take that homework for him. So I take to Facebook, of course. And I type, lest any of you think this is easy for me, know that my son's homework is sitting on the table in the other room and I have to be at the school in 1 hour and I really want to take it and I know I can't take it. Post. And the comments start rolling in. And one of them comes down the line, one of them comes from my friend Lisa Heffernan, who writes a blog called Grown and Flown about getting older kids out of the nest, getting them off to college. I love her blog. It's fantastic. If you have older kids, you should read it. And she said, Jess, you know I respect you, but I disagree. As a family, we do things for the people we love. If your husband left his phone charger at home, you would take it to him at work. And you model that for your kids, because we want our kids to know that we have each other's backs, that we're a unit. I was like, she's so right. I have done that. I brought it to this very room, as a matter of fact. So I stalked around the room for a while. Time's getting close. I got to leave soon. And I realized, yes, you're right. I would take my husband's charger to him at work. But I'm not raising my husband. I am, however, raising a kid who has a lot of trouble getting the homework off the table and into the backpack, out of the backpack, and into its proper location in the classroom. And that's what we've been working on for like 2 months. And if I take that homework, I short circuit all that work we've done over the past 2 months. So I make cookies instead because I have to do something. And so he comes through the door at the end of the day, and I'm like tapping my fingers, just waiting. And he comes through the door, and I said, "How was your day?" And he said, "It was great." And I said, "Really? Because of homework and right over there." And he's like, "Oh, yeah, I forgot my homework." And I'm like, "Yes, I know." And he said, I said, "What happened with that?" And he said, "Well, you know, as some of you recognize his name, one of my favorite teachers around. Well, you know, Mr. Dano said that I had to do some extra work during lunch. But then we sat down together because he said we really have to come up with a way of making it so that I can remember how to bring my homework in." And I realized I could make a checklist. And I said, "That's brilliant. I happen to have some index cards right over here. And you could, like, you know, clip it to stuff and put, because I love checklists." And it was that checklist he created that day. If you've read my New York Times column, you've probably seen it because it's shown up in pictures a lot. It's still on our refrigerator, and that was 2.5 years ago. The first item on it is clothes, which I find very sweet. Because if he's forgetting his clothes, we have a much bigger problem. Clothes, lunch, feed the dog, you know, all that kind of stuff he has to do before he can get out the door in the morning at exactly, by the way, he has it down to the minute. He has to walk out the door at 7:21 in order to run to the bus stop so that he intersects the bus as it comes down the street. It's like, it's a science. But that checklist has made it so that 97% of the time, he remembers his homework, at least getting it in the bag and stuff. So I had this realization that the most important thing always on my checklist at the end of the day is, was I a good parent today? And the easy way to check that box off is to have those moments where you show up at school with the homework, and in front of all of his friends, he says, "Oh, Mommy, I love you so much. You have my back. Thank you so much for bringing my homework." That's sort of how it goes in my fantasy head, in my fantasy life. It doesn't really go that way. What actually happens is he's like, "Oh, thanks." You know, it probably means more to me than it does to him. But that's the easy way to check that box off. Yes, I showed my love today. But I was realizing that actually his checklist is the important one. The fact that he came up with his own checklist is like the way I check off my box. That's the way I am able to say, yeah, I was a good parent, maybe not necessarily today, but over this week or this month or this year. You know, I want the ability to look back over a year and say, is my kid more competent than he was a year ago? Did I make the right choices about his autonomy and his competence and our connection as a family over this year? And that list, his checklist, has become the thing I need to look at all the time to remind myself that that's the important part of this equation. There is one last thing on my checklist I wanted to share with you. So there was a question about that Hal, that soliloquy. In Henry IV, Part 1, Henry is a terrible king. He is a horrible king. He stole the throne from another king. There's now civil war across the land because everyone figures, ooh, anyone can steal the throne now, and it's terrible. So what he really needs is he needs his son to ascend to the throne and be a really good king. And as luck would have it, he has a son. His son's name is Hal, and Hal doesn't want to be king. So when I give this talk to kids, I ask students, you know, how would your parents go about convincing you to do something that you don't want to do? And they're like, oh, they'd bribe me, or they'd offer me a car if I was, you know, would be a king, whatever. So Henry tries a lot of that stuff. He threatens him, he bribes him. He says horrible things to him, like, see that guy over there? I wish some night-tripping fairy had switched the two of you at birth, and he was my son, not you, because he's going to be a better king than you ever would. But essentially, the king calls Hal in and has one of those moments where he really, they have a knockdown drag out about, you know, how things are going to go, that Hal is going to step up to the plate whether he likes it or not. And then everyone leaves the stage except for Hal. Shakespeare soliloquies are done for one of two reasons. They're done either to show you what's going on in the actor's mind, like Hamlet's to be or not to be speech, or they're done, as they are in this speech, to tell you something that no one else knows. It's called dramatic irony. And that's what this one is about. So Hal, everyone leaves the stage. Hal's just been screamed at by his father for not wanting to be king and for needing to step up to the plate. And Hal says this: "I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humor of your idleness. Yet herein, I will imitate the sun, who doth permit the base contagious clouds to smother up his beauty from the world. Yet when he please again to be himself, being wanted, he should be more wondered at, by breaking through the foul and ugly mist that did seem smother him from the world. If all the year were playing holidays, to sport would be as tedious as to work. But when they come, they wished for come, and nothing pleaseth like rare accidents. So when this loose behavior I throw off, and pay the debt I never promised, by so much more than my word I am, by so much will I falsify men's hopes, like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation glittering o'er my faults, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men think least I will." So I went in and I asked my eighth graders, I said, "What did Hal just say to us, and why are you guys fighting over this soliloquy?" And one of the boys, who will go unnamed, said, "Because he's giving his dad the finger." And I said, "That's exactly what he's doing." And we had such a great discussion about it. And they said, basically, because Hal knows he's going to be king. Hal fully intends to be king. Except he's not going to be a king like that guy. He's not going to do it on that guy's timeline the way that guy did it, because everyone hates him. Plus, that Hotspur guy that his dad says would prefer he was his son, that guy's good all the time. Everyone expects him to be good all the time. If I'm a jerk now and I totally slough off on my responsibilities now, and then I become a fantastic king, man, then people are really going to really appreciate me. And Hal does. Hal is King Henry V, Battle of Agincourt, St. Crispin's Day speech. And yes, I know Shakespearean history and regular history and real history are not the same thing. But let's just pretend for a second. He's a great king. He's one of the most important kings in English history. Because he does it on his own timeline, according to when he's ready, according to how he wants to do it. He controls the where, when, why, and how. So we're not raising princes and princesses, although many of us would like to think we are. But if this guy who likes to hang out in the bawdy houses and eat capons and drink beer and steal money from pilgrims on their way to Canterbury Cathedral, imagine what our kids can do. Thank you. My voice, but I've been on the road for like 3 weeks, and I just flew in a couple days ago on a red eye, and I managed to somewhere along the line catch a cold, so I'm sort of trying to hold it together. But I have time for some questions. Yes.
So I have a
I'll restate. So
I have a sixth grade boy, 11 years old, who school has been pretty easy for him, and he finishes his homework really quickly, and mm-hmm. I don't ever see him having to work very hard,
mm-hmm.
and I have been so worried every year about what's going to happen when he gets to seventh or eighth grade and it starts getting hard.
Right.
And so the initial time he has a long-term project and needs to kind of plan
uh-huh.
and work through some stuff.
Yeah, it's a disaster. Yeah. Okay. So
I don't know as a parent what to do.
Okay. Well, first thing I'm going to tell you is welcome to middle school. Middle school, just so you know, it's a setup, okay? So the way middle school is structured is far more complex than their poor little frontal lobes can handle. So as middle school teachers, we know that. Part of what we do is we teach them how to use a plan book, and they try it this way, and then that doesn't work. And then we try it with them this way, and that doesn't work. And then we try it with them this way, and that doesn't work. It's like try, fail. That's what middle school is. That's why my book is... Really, the heart of the book is middle school. And although there's a chapter in it that's called middle school, it really should be called Welcome to Executive Function Land, because that's what that chapter's about. And it's all about figuring out strategies to help kids with their executive function skills and figuring out ways to help them learn about long-term planning. And that is such a process, and it's not a linear process. It's like those stock market charts that go like this. Like, you eventually end up higher than where you started, but there's a lot of up and down along the way. And boys in particular, 11, 12, executive function, they lag behind the girls. So the girls are held up as paragons of, oh, look how she did it. You know, it's so wonderful. But on the other hand, girls are also in middle school aren't ready for, you know, some of the stuff that happens in algebra. That's when they're first told that they're not good at math. But that's all also not because they're not good at math, but because their brain hasn't made the connections yet to be able to handle some of those concepts. So that's when girls lose interest in math, and that's when I was told I was bad at math. It turns out I'm perfectly fine at math, thank you very much. I just wasn't ready for it then. And same thing with the boys. We chastise the boys for being so disorganized. Pull up your pants, do your belt. They can't keep their pants pulled up and their books in their arms at the same time. It's just too much. So a lot of patience is required, but I'm going to direct you to that chapter because it gets really specific about strategies. And I have a lot of people from Dartmouth to thank for that, because a lot of people came together and sort of helped me learn about executive function and learn about some ways of handling that. And namely, Bill Hudenko is my hero. So yeah, I'll direct you to that stuff. And I've written a bunch of articles on sort of middle school boys and executive function, and there's a bunch of books that I recommend when it comes to executive function that are just like Late Lost and Unprepared. And there's another book called That Crumpled Piece of Paper Was Due Last Week. That's a good one. That's by Anna Homayun. It's a really good book. Anyone else? Yes, on the end.
You spoke about extrinsic rewards for academic tasks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on a token economy for behavior.
It doesn't work. So like charts with stars and all that stuff, it would be really nice if we, you know, didn't do that. But here's the problem, is that it's really hard. One of the things we're doing is asking kids to get academically serious much earlier than we ever did before. And academic rigor at a much younger age requires a lot more behavioral control than some kids are capable of at that. So we use every sort of lever that we can, and many of those are stars or whatever. If you have to use systems like that, I visited a school last week that had a really neat thing. They used a system like that, but it was sort of points toward guitar time at the end of the day where they could sing and stuff. This was a kindergarten classroom. One of the ways you can earn points is by owning up to your mistakes, admitting to your mistakes and working through them. And the teachers will strategically make mistakes themselves so that students can see them owning their mistakes and earning guitar time too. So that modeling of being motivated by goals instead of grades, or being motivated to take emotional and intellectual risks, all of that, I talk about it a lot in the grades chapter, especially because that's sort of the system we work within now. Part of what moving away from grades can do, even if it's just at home, because kids know grades are the be-all, end-all of their existence at this point in time. We don't need to be telling them at home, too, that it is the be-all, end-all of their existence. If we could start focusing more on goals and things like that, and showing them that we focus on goals, that we try to take emotional risks and intellectual risks with our own lives by setting goals for ourselves that are challenging, screwing up, and trying it again. That's the most effective thing that we can do for kids. As far as the business model, the pay-for-play business model, you know, we all see, and Dan Pink raves, you know, rants about this. We know that short-term incentives to get people motivated to do creative things and to do long-term things does not work. And yet we persist in doing it despite the fact that we know it does not work over the long term and has a detrimental effect on motivation. As I said before, if you want your kid to not like math, I mean, think about it this way. We give kids pizza coupons for reading books in the summer. If we really cared about the books, we would give them books for eating pizza, right? But instead what we're saying is we're going to give you this thing we really value, free pizza, if you'll just do this over the thing over here. Or I'm going to pay you in currency, which everyone knows is what drives our society. It's like the most precious thing, except for, you know, maybe our family members in our world. And then we tell our kids, in exchange for those grades, I'm going to give you this thing that's really precious to me. So we reinforce for them that what we really care about are the grades, not necessarily the learning that's happening to get to the grades. So a lot more emphasis on process over product. We tend to talk a lot about product in this society, and if we could shift that to process, we would be doing a lot of people a great service. And education is slowly moving that way. I don't know what's happening in the business world, but they don't seem to be particularly interested in the fact that what we've known for 40 years. So we'll see. That's why, like, 20% Google time, which actually doesn't exist anymore, but a lot of businesses that give, that require their employees to work for a certain period of time. At some companies, it's like Project Fridays, or that one thing had something or other Friday night where you had to come in, you would work, but on Friday afternoon, you could not work on anything that was directly related to something you had to do for work. And one company had two employees there that ended up with a Nobel Prize for the work they did during that period because they were so motivated to do it. But it didn't have anything to do with their incentive system at work. It was completely outside of work. Google used to do what's called 20% time at Google, which is 20% of the time you're supposed to work on projects that don't have anything to do with your actual job. They phased that out, but it exists. It exists. I was there just the other day, and I asked about it, and no one wanted to talk about it. It was really interesting. One last question I think I have time for. Like I said, the book is very much about the research. My talk is very much about the research. The book is very much about the specifics. As I went out on the road to talk about this stuff, I realized what people really wanted to know was how do I do X? How do I back off around homework? How do I back off around sports? How do I back off around grades? How do I back off around social life? And that's all in there. I just don't have time to talk about every single aspect of it when I'm doing the talk. But thank you so, so much for your time.